From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now, take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
Welcome to School Talks. With school just around the corner, we have two important guests on the show today. Kim Root from the Michigan State Police Office of School Safety, and Brian Grant, an attorney with one of our core sponsors, O'Reilly Rancilio. All this and more coming up. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Kim Root, the Department Manager for the Office of School Safety with the Michigan State Police. Welcome to the program, Kim.
Thank you.
So in our continuing focus on school safety throughout school year, I wanted to have you back given the number of things that have changed since the last time we chat. And I think a great place to start would be, what are some of the most significant legislative changes regarding school safety for Michigan schools that have taken effect in 2025?
Yeah, that's a great question, Bob. And I will speak mostly to those legislative changes that impact the Office of School Safety and for which we will be involved with. And probably one of the most significant is the requirement for schools to have behavioral threat assessment and management teams in place by actually 2026. We know a lot of schools are moving in this direction already. So the fact that we have legislation around behavioral threat assessment should not be a surprise. There are at least 20 other states that have a requirement for behavioral threat assessment and management teams in schools. And so Michigan, is now part of those ranks. And this law goes into effect really essentially for the next school year. And the requirement is that schools have at least a school administrator, a school resource officer, and a mental health professional serving on those behavioral threat assessment teams. Others can be part of those teams as well, but at a minimum, they need to have a school administrator, a school resource officer, or law enforcement officer, and then a mental health professional as part of those teams. The next most significant probably for schools is one related to standardized terminology. So we know, and I know having worked in schools for decades, that schools and responding organizations are all over the map in terms of the words that they use to describe actions in an emergency situation. And so the legislation around standard terminology is designed to create that standardization from school building to school building, from school district to school district, and then have that be standardized across the state. Again, a number of states are moving in this direction so that emergency responders, law enforcement, and schools are all on the same page when it comes to a lockdown situation or when it comes to an evacuation situation. And so that standard terminology has to go into effect by, again, the next school year. The Michigan State Police Office of School Safety is charged with promulgating rules around that standard terminology. One of the challenges associated with that, however, is that we need to work with the next piece of legislation that I was going to address is the School Safety and Mental Health Commission. And we're required to collaborate with the School Safety and Mental Health Commission in establishing that standard terminology, but that commission hasn't been seated yet. Only a portion of those members have been assigned, have been named so far. And so we're waiting for that full commission to be named so that we can have a commission meeting and then present our recommendations for standard terminology and then hope that those are accepted so that we can share that and communicate that across the state and move schools in the direction of complying with that standard terminology. This is where we are today, mm-hmm. is the legislation repealed two previous commissions. One was the School Safety Commission, operated by the Michigan State Police, and then one was the School Safety and Mental Health Commission under the auspices of the Wayne RESA, the Regional Educational Services Agency. And so now there's just one commission. We're waiting for that full commission to be seated so that we can collaborate with that commission and then publish the new rules around standard terminology. That's where we are today. So those three pieces of legislation, the behavioral threat assessment, the standard terminology, and the School Safety and Mental Health Commission, those are high on our list in terms of priorities and in terms of helping schools be compliant with the new legislation.
When I think about the importance of standard terminology, it makes me think about when the pressure really mounted on schools to determine whether a student was safe to be in school. As I know you experienced, and I certainly did, there were a lot of staff who felt like they did not want to be responsible for saying such and such student is safe to be in school, God forbid something happened.
Right.
And there was a short time when we experienced the same thing from the agencies outside of schools who were being asked, hey, can you write us a letter of guarantee that this child will not be a threat? And they're like, wait, nobody wanted to take, full responsibility. So the reason I bring the standard terminology thing together is by creating a consistent nomenclature, it gives the opportunity for people to collaborate and actually improve their training and readiness, which brings me to a next point. How is your office helping schools implement these requirements around this new standardization?
Sure. And so let me address first behavioral threat assessment, because I think that that's also, one of the things that you're talking about is, by having a multidisciplinary team in place for behavioral threat assessment and management, it means it doesn't fall on one person's shoulders. It means that, each of us brings a different piece of the puzzle to the table when we're talking about a kid who may be struggling. And so our goal with behavioral threat assessment and what we've been training around the state since 2022 is really this notion that we come to the table with various pieces of the puzzle. And the end game really is not to necessarily even discipline students. In some cases, that's going to be necessary. But our goal with behavioral threat assessment is to make sure that we're getting students the help that they need, because some of them are, reacting very emotionally. Some of them are struggling, socially and emotionally. There might be issues at home that we don't know about. And so, again, the goal really is to get that student the help that they need. Since 2022, the Office of School Safety, working with Raptor Technologies and then its predecessor, ONTIC, we have delivered school safety, behavioral threat assessment training around the state to more than 4,000 school personnel and law enforcement professionals. And again, the goal there really is to help schools build their teams. Some folks came to our training knowing and already having teams in place. Some school districts came to our trainings really starting from scratch to build their teams again, the goal is really to get students the help that they need. Mm-hmm. And one of the pieces that we have found that schools are really struggling with, and so we're going to address that in our upcoming School Safety Academy, is the management component. So, it's one thing to do the threat assessment. It's another thing then to have a plan in place for how to manage that student's needs across a period of time. A management plan might last 2 weeks. A management plan might last 2 months. It could last 2 years. But the goal, again, really is to not just check the box on threat assessment, but really make sure that we're putting the pieces in place to give that student the support they need.
Mm-hmm. So listen, we need to take a short break to hear from our sponsors. When we come back, though, I'd like to talk more about what some of the training programs are available for schools across the state and the actual Public Act 271. So if you'll stay with me, we'll be back right after this. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Once again at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
Welcome back to School Talks. We're continuing our conversation with Kim Root, the department manager of the Office of School Safety at the Michigan State Police. And Kim, before the break, we were talking about all of the needs around threat assessment teams and that. Talked a little bit about how many people, when this first began, were a little hands-off as to wanting to be the one responsible to say a student can come back to school. And when I think about the teachers in the trenches, I know so many of them who feel like this is not what they signed up for. They love kids, they love to teach subject matter, and this is a pretty heavy lift for them when you think about the challenge of educating children essentially on a good day. But with that, could you tell us a bit about the School Safety Academy and the Youth Violence Prevention Summits that you're part of?
Absolutely. Over the past 2 years, we've built the School Safety Academy, which really is intended to provide those who have a role in school safety the tools and tactics and training they need to take their work to the next level. When we think about school safety, a lot of times schools think about their emergency operations plans, and that's kind of it. But we know school safety involves so much more than just emergency operations plans. It's everything from school climate and culture to mental health, to laws and policies, board policies associated with school safety. And so our goal really is to bring school safety to the next level by giving a big picture view of what school safety means, and then bringing in national and statewide speakers to deliver information about best practices, to have schools really drill down into what's working for them and what's not working for them, to help schools identify the gaps in their school safety planning, and then really test it out. One of the sessions that we're offering in this upcoming School Safety Academy is actually having incidents. So fast response to incidents that occur every day. And while we know that active assailant gets top billing when we think about school safety, that there are lots of things that happen in schools that are emergency situations. For example, weather-related emergencies, bus accidents, conflicts among parents. So we address those in the School Safety Academy, and that's one of the things that I'm proudest of, is the fact that it's ever-changing, so it's not the same academy year to year, and we try to address, the emerging and trending topics in school safety. And then this year, we proudly added a youth summit to all of the School Safety Academies. So it's either the day before or the day after the two-day academy, because we think that one of the voices left out in this conversation about how we improve school safety is the student voice. So we want to hear from students about what the adults in the room are doing well and what they could do better. We recognize that students have been growing up with school safety drills and hardening of our school buildings and emergency operations plans, but do they feel safer? And are these things working? And so we want that voice at the table. And that's really what the Youth Summit is about is sharing information and then collecting information from students so that we can then put that together for the School Safety and Mental Health Commission and share that information with them, share that with the legislature and our director, Colonel Grady of the Michigan State Police, and then, you know, have that potentially turn into policy considerations.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I think about the current debate over cell phones being banned in schools, I think about how that aspect of technology exacerbates someone's feeling of whether they're safe or not at school, just given how rapid children can communicate with one another. And I see an interesting intersection possibly in the future as it relates to what access kids have, which I know is a major concern for some parents, especially those parents who have those apps on their phone that track their child's every move. Like Life 360, and I think some of those parents may have some serious concerns about not being able to get a hold of their child, especially in an emergency. And it'll be interesting to see how that all sort of shakes out legislatively. And I thought of that when you mentioned the policy implications of how this happens. One last question: what training materials or workshops are now required for school employees, as if there are, as a result of this legislation or any policy changes? Are there any particular requirements you could share with us?
There are not requirements. What we offer tends to be, you know, we offer these the School Safety Academy as well as our threat assessment training free of charge, and our goal really is to build capacity in the state of Michigan for whether it's behavioral threat assessment or it's learning about culture and climate and the impact that that has on school safety, or whether it's mental health first aid training. Our goal really, like I said, is to build capacity. We want people to have this information. We want schools and school personnel to feel as prepared as they can be in emergency situations. So there are not specific requirements for school resource officers, for example, or school safety liaisons. Mm-hmm. But what we offer tends to be best practice. And there may be a time in the future where we're moving toward requirements or certification for school resource officers and school safety personnel, but we're not at that point yet. And so we're trying to be ahead of that game by offering the kinds of trainings that may be required in the future and just being ahead of the legislation, if you will.
Sure. And, you know, I think the dissolution of the two independent commissions, creating one, coupled with the standardization of language, sort of the nomenclature, is a big step in the right direction, just given the number of things that are out there that you can use to stay safe, whether it's Alice or run, hide, fight, all those terms. Having those standardized, I think, improves the entire capacity of the business. And on that note, Kim Root, the Department Manager of the Office of School Safety for the Michigan State Police, thanks so much for stopping by the program and giving us an update. I will certainly keep your number handy, and as always, keep up the great work.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after a word from our sponsors, we'll chat with Brian Grant, an attorney with O'Reilly Rancilio. And if you have young children and do not have a will or a plan to care for them if something happens to you, you'll want to tune in. Stay right there. We'll be back right after this.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Brian Grant, an estate planning and probate attorney with O'Reilly Rancilio. And it's certainly worth noting that O'Reilly Rancilio Law is one of School Talk's primary sponsors, and we appreciate their continued support. And with that, welcome to the program, Brian.
Thank you, Dr. Livernoy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Appreciate it. So from time to time, we step away from your typical school topics to examine things that affect families who are raising children and so on. And in doing some research of the work you're doing at the firm, something that intrigued me that I think many parents don't think about is what happens to their minor children if something, God forbid, happens to them, especially both of them, where the children need to go somewhere. And I think a good place to start would be for you to help us understand what the difference between guardianship, and I think the term is conservatorship, is for minors. And how do those interact, or how is each one of those required? Tell us a bit about that.
It's a very good question. This is something that comes up quite frequently in my meetings when I meet with some of my clients who have minor children and asking about what would happen in the event of a catastrophic issue if both of them happen to pass. A minor guardianship is a guardianship in general affects the legal decision-making. So when it comes to minor children, it's typically what school is the child going to attend, what medical procedures or treatments. The guardian is the one that makes those types of legal decisions. Mm-hmm. Conservatorship is essentially the financial aspect of it. So if both parents pass and the minor inherits money and there's no testamentary documents like a trust in place, then the conservatorship is where a person is appointed to handle the minor's finances. So what happens to their money and what it can be spent on.
Mm-hmm. So for our School Talks listeners out there who are parents, help us understand, what would the process be for appointing a guardian for minor children in the event something unexpected happens?
So the process involves the probate court. Most people are afraid of the probate court, but in a situation that both parents are unavailable or incapable due to death or incapacity of being able to care for their minor children, a person has to go file a petition with the probate court. Guardianship and conservatorship are two different proceedings. So you file a petition for a guardianship, a petition for conservatorship. And what the courts will typically look for is, did the parents have a will and testament where they nominate who they would like to care for the minor children, take care of them, both their health and their finances? In the event that there isn't a last will and testament or a document that nominates somebody, the court will typically look to Michigan statutes to determine who has the priority. So the first step, though, is a person has to go file a petition, state what happened, tell the probate court why the parents can't care for the minor child anymore due to death or incapacity or unavailability, and then the probate court will have a hearing where they go through and determine who's the most suitable and then appoint that person.
Mm-hmm. So a follow-up question to that. In a family that has a will or some type of document that directs who will care for their children, does that still need to go through probate to make that happen?
Yes. So okay. Even if someone has a will that says, I want my brother, sister, or whoever it is to be the one that cares for my minor children, ultimately, the power to make that decision rests with the probate court. And when the probate court does finally make that decision, they will issue what are called letters of guardianship and letters of conservatorship for the minor child. That's the document. So if a child goes to a school and says, I want to enroll this person in this school, mm-hmm. they will ask for the letter of guardianship to make sure that the person that's doing that actually has the authority to enroll the child. Or likewise with a medical appointment or making medical decisions, a doctor will ask for the letter of guardianship in order to provide information and allow that person to receive information and make medical decisions on behalf of the minor child.
Mm-hmm. We're currently chatting with Brian Grant, attorney with O'Reilly Rancilio, about the issue of minor guardianship and conservatorship. Brian, there's an old saying in my family that weddings and funerals bring out the best and the worst in people. And I have to imagine in your line of work that the court at times must face the decision of who becomes the guardian, especially if there are multiple family members willing to serve, or maybe there are disagreements among relatives. Can you comment on that a bit for us?
Yes. So in most situations, when guardianships and conservatorships of minor children are before the court, there aren't a lot of family fights because there's a nomination or people in the family discuss it. However, if there is a fight, then the probate court has to determine who they think is the most suitable person for the minor child. So that might involve multiple hearings. There might be a trial, and ultimately the court will have to make the determination. And I will say they get messy. Family members like to throw stones. Things that happened long ago in the past that you might have even forgotten about all of a sudden come out about how you treated me bad or said bad things. So, yeah, the probate courts have the unfortunate role of the airing of family grievances while they are sometimes making these decisions. And it's very difficult for the probate court because there's a minor child involved, and that's really what everyone should be focused on.
Mm-hmm. Is the decision of the probate court able to be appealed?
Yes. There is always an appellate process, which is rather lengthy. In the event that the probate court can't determine who is the best or there's a major fight, they might appoint a public administrator or somebody else, a professional, in the meantime to make sure that the minor child is cared for. But ultimately, yes, the decision of the judge can be appealed.
And, you know, you mentioned the family might, I think you used the term throw stones. It feels very much like what happens in politics when someone runs for office and all of a sudden something from 20 years ago comes out that they were late on a water bill or some obscure fault that happened to them years ago. It seems very similar that could unfold like this. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Things that happened long ago that should have no bearing on the proceedings come out, and the family members, just whatever ammunition they have, sometimes they try to use.
Yeah, interesting comment. Listen, Brian, I'd like to take a short break to hear from our sponsors. When we come back, though, I'd like to talk a little bit more about what's in the best interest of the child, especially what's at risk for them, depending on where they end up. So if you'll stay with us, we'll be right back. This is 760 WJR.
Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Welcome back to School Talks. We're chatting with Brian Grant, an estate planning and probate attorney with O'Reilly Rancilio, one of the core sponsors of School Talks. We appreciate the continued support from them. So, Brian, before the break, we were talking about the potential fight that a family could have over where a minor child ends up in the event that he or she loses both parents. And a question within that, sort of in that lane, is if a parent leaves no will or clear documentation about guardianship, what are the actual risks for the minor child? And more importantly, how disruptive can that be for them?
Great question. So in the event a parent doesn't leave any sort of nomination of who they want to care for their minor child or children, if they're not able to, what we run into is we have to look to Michigan law that says who could potentially serve as the child's minor guardian. This can be pretty disruptive because there are times where the family members who might have priority might not live in the state or might not be necessarily the best person or persons to care for the minor child. So sometimes when you consider where the child goes to school, where their friend group is, what sports they play, some parents might say, well, my siblings or whoever else might live out of state, so I have a best friend, and I'd prefer my best friend be it because they're in the local area. If there's no will or other document that would allow that, then they might have to move out of state. They might have to get a new friend group, and it becomes extremely troubling for them because they're already dealing with a very difficult situation where they don't have their parents anymore. Now they don't have their parents. They're getting upended from their entire life.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting upended from their school. They're getting upended from their sports. They're getting upended from everything they know. And they're getting uprooted to somewhere. And they might not even know the people necessarily that are caring for them. So they might not have a relationship with an aunt, uncle, brother, sister, whoever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have to go live with that person, and that person who might not know them has to make all the decisions for them. So it can be extremely disruptive in their life.
It certainly seems that way. So following up on that, wherever the child ends up, does that particular guardian have any ongoing responsibilities as far as reporting to the court or things like that once the minor is with them?
Yes. So there will be reports that have to be filed with the court to make sure that the placement is appropriate, that the, in the event of a conservator, the conservator is not wasting or dissipating the minor's assets for their own use, and that the minor is just doing well. So there are reviews that the court conducts in order to make sure that the guardianship and conservatorship remain appropriate.
Can parents appoint different people as guardian and conservator? One is to take care of the child, the other is to manage the money. Can they have two different people? And if so, what are the pros and cons of separating those roles?
Yes, they can appoint different people or nominate different people to be a guardian and a conservator. So where that comes in is you might have a person that's better at caring for the minor's legal needs, their school, their medical, and all the like. Then you might have another person in the family that might be a financial planner, and you think, oh, that person would probably be in the best situation to control their finances. So they nominate two different people, which happens, and it's perfectly fine. However, there are times where there can be a conflict, because if the guardian wants the minor child to do something, play in a sport, get a laptop for school, go somewhere, do something with school, and the conservator disagrees, then the conservator might say, I'm not providing funds from the minor's money in order to do what it is you're asking me to do. So normally that doesn't happen, but there is a potential conflict that can arise in that situation.
So we're chatting here with Brian Grant from O'Reilly Rancilio about the issues and implications of minor guardianship and minor conservatorship. And Brian, what are the main reasons a court might reject the parent's chosen guardian or conservator?
The only time that's typically going to happen is if the court determines that the person that's been nominated is not suitable to serve in that role. A guardian and conservators are fiduciaries, so they're people that are in a position of trust. If the nominated person has a history that would indicate that you can't trust them, such as criminal convictions, bankruptcies, various things that happen that give most people, you know, pause for concern as to whether they are suitable, the courts will consider that, and they might determine that this isn't appropriate to name them or appoint them as the guardian or conservator.
And in cases of a limited or temporary guardianship, what rights do surviving relatives or the child's parents retain, and how easily can those arrangements be changed or dissolved later, especially if it's a limited or finite situation?
So when you're in a limited guardianship, that is a situation where the parents typically agree that somebody else should care for their minor child at the time if they're not capable of doing so. What happens in those situations is the court will put in place what's called a limited placement plan. It has different things that have to be followed. It allows for the visitation. It allows for parenting, custody classes, all the like. So that way the parent can become better at what it is they're supposed to be doing. Those can be modified. Those are reviewed. They're not meant to be permanent. That's why it's a limited placement plan. And the ultimate goal is reunification with the person's children. So those are typically what you look at when the parents might not be deceased or something else, but they're just not able to care for their child at the time. And those can be, again, those can be terminated, modified, depending on the situation.
So for a family considering some form of minor guardianship, et cetera, I'm certain the state has laws that affect how this process works, but are there specific forms or requirements that parents should know about?
There are forms. Basically, the main thing is it's a petition, and the petition will fall on the person that wants to be appointed, the guardian or conservatorship or both. So there are forms in place, but I don't want to say that they should be, they should know about them or anything else. If they are considering, if a parent is considering giving the power, the guardianship or conservatorship of their children over to somebody else, then they may want to consult with an attorney or have the person mm-hmm. that would be becoming the guardian or conservator consult with an attorney to make sure that it's done appropriately and there aren't really any hiccups in the process. Because again, we're looking at what's in the best interest of the minor child.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what everybody always has to consider when doing anything with guardianships and conservatorships in this situation.
And when I think about consulting an attorney, I think about Brian Grant from O'Reilly Rancilio. You have really given our listeners something to think about. It's something that most of us don't anticipate. I freely admit that when my children were young, I never even thought of this because most people don't like to think that something like that would happen. For you, Brian, at O'Reilly Rancilio, if people need to get in touch with you, they certainly can call 586-726-1000 and ask for Brian Grant if you're interested in this process. Brian, you've given us some really good stuff. I appreciate your time. And as always, keep up the good work.
I really appreciate it, Dr. Livernoy. Thank you.
I'd like to thank our guests today, Kim Root from the Michigan State Police Office of School Safety, and attorney Brian Grant from one of our core sponsors, O'Reilly Rancilio, for two really very different perspectives on how to keep children safe, one at school and one, God forbid, if there's a tragedy in the home where a child loses both parents or caregivers. A really interesting conversation today. Looking ahead, for most of you, schools will start in the next 2 or 3 weeks. Some start before Labor Day, others start after. And I wanted to let you know that coming up on School Talks in September, we're going to take a deep dive into a red-hot issue in schools, and that is whether cell phones should be banned. If you haven't been following, this issue has been under discussion in the state legislature. There has been legislation proposed. At one time, it failed to pass. And the issue continues to be at front and center of whether these cell phones should be allowed in schools. In fact, some lawmakers have proposed restrictions, but none have passed. The governor supports limiting phone use. She actually believes this helps students focus, improves their mental health, and reduces bullying. However, decisions are mostly made by local school districts. And currently, even before this cell phone issue became law, many schools have had varying degrees of rules about cell phone use. Some students must keep phones away during class to avoid distractions. And in many cases, some teachers use them as part of the instruction in the classroom. And I do know from my personal experience, many parents worry about communication during emergencies. And many schools examine exceptions that they can make for emergencies and medical needs. Without question, as we approach the start of school, the debate is going to be about balancing the benefits of banning cell phones as well as the concerns. And that is all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank you for joining us on School Talks. And remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.